Should we do class now? Stop talking now. It's my turn. What's up with this? Am I just not enunciating? See all people out in webland, this is what I have to deal with. If only everyone were as quiet as those out in the web. All right, let's wrap up the features because I'm tired of it. Jump to page 66. Actually, go to 67. So Socrates and Phaedrus are going back and forth. They're talking about establishing the science of rhetoric. Not really critiquing rhetoric, they're critiquing the possibility of a science of rhetoric, which we'll get to in a second. And they cite Tisias, who is a sophist, who's written these sophistic texts, these technes, as they're called, is full of shit. And so they're going to tell him that he's full of shit. And so there's this weird passage where they actually quote, right? So you look at 66 onto 67, they sort of stop, and Peter says, ah, 'twas a wonderfully recondite art that Tisias seems to have brought to light. And he's kidding, of course, because the art that he's brought to light is nonsense. Or whoever it may have been, whatever name he wants to call him. But friend, shall we or shall we not say to him, what shall we say, says Phaedrus. And then Socrates says something, but it's in quotes. He's talking to Tisias, but he's in quotes. Isn't this a strange thing? Here comes his final confrontation with an absent sophist. Presumably he's going to confront rhetoric now, right? In the form of Tisias. But it's in the form of a quote. Why? What's going on here? Why doesn't he just say it in his own words? Why is it in quotation marks? Who's speaking if it's in quotation marks? Does anybody find that odd? I sure do. Okay. So we have Socrates here presumably critiquing rhetoric for somehow being further from the truth, right? And for his own art being this art of being self-present, this art of owning your own words, yet in this exact moment where he's going to tell rhetoric, right, this in the form of Tisias, what he thinks of it, he says it as a version of writing, right? Because quotation marks are a version of writing. They're not your own words. They're a borrowing, right? They're a tissue of quotations, like Bart talks about. Right? So he's taking this quotation, he's quoting himself. What's happening here? Is he not speaking? Who's speaking here? When you see these what are they called again? Quotation marks. Sorry, I'm not having coffee today. I'll drink my tea faster. It's a little strange. N'est-ce pas? All right. And then Phaedrus says at the end, very well spoken, which is, again, hilarious, right? Phaedrus, you can never figure out if he's ever come anywhere. Very well spoken. What does it mean, very well spoken? Does that mean you spoke about the good? Or does that mean you said it nicely? What does it mean to speak well? Very well spoken, says Phaedrus. And Socrates says, well, even an attempt to reach the good is probably good for one. I mean whatever experience an attempt may bring. This word experience is interesting because it is the grounds of his critique of rhetoric. Right? The grounds of his critique of rhetoric is so far has been the grounds of a critique of the science of rhetoric, which means establishing the art of circumstantial language as a science is necessarily faulty. As I told you all semester, I told you the very first day of class, how can you have rules for rhetoric? It doesn't make any sense. If rhetoric is the art of saying the right thing at the right time, if it's a temporal art, it's always circumstantial, then how can I possibly have a science of it? What rules could I tell you? How could I ever tell you beforehand what the best thing to do is? Right? The only rhetorical rule is do the right thing at the right time. That's the only thing we can say. Right, which is a very strange thing to say. It can't really be a science. It will always remain a kind of art, always a kind of practice, which means that learning to be a rhetorician, like learning, let's say, to be an athlete, is always grounded in experience. Right? I can't really teach Derek Jeter to be a better shortstop in the dugout. I can do certain things. I can pep him up. I can show him lots of videos. But that's not going to make him a better shortstop. At some point, I'm going to have to hit him balls. Right? It has to be experience, lived through. One thing I've tried to argue is that Socrates proffers in his irony, he proffers a way of going that is always, in fact, precisely a way of going. That you don't know the truth, you live through a certain experience. Right? That it's always a living through, it is always temporal. His art of philosophy is similar to the art of rhetoric that we talk about in that it is temporal. It is experienced. Does that make sense? So here's Socrates saying, I mean whatever experience an attempt may bring. Again, this word kind of rings because it's experience versus science that he set up here. Nietzsche sets it up as well. He sets up this seeming dichotomy between the flow of time and the stability of concepts. Right? Socrates does it here too. He talks about the sort of ambivalence of experience, right? The circumstantial nature of experience and the sort of a fixity of science. But the relationship that this text sets up between those two terms and Nietzsche's text sets up between those two terms is radically different. That is a good topic for a paper. Right? It is, if you can show how Socrates privileges experience over science, over fixity, like Nietzsche does, and then show how Socrates is fundamentally very different than what Nietzsche has to offer, you will have taught me something about both texts. All right. Sure. We got to do that. And Socrates says, yet there remains the matter of propriety and impropriety in writing. What conditions make it proper or improper? Isn't that so? So remember, this whole exchange about language, about rhetoric, began with them trying to decide how they could tell good writing from bad writing. But it turns out they never talked about that. That's what Socrates says here. It still remains. What they've talked about is the necessary failure of a science of rhetoric. Right? Rhetoric will never succeed as a set of rules. But they haven't yet answered the question, how do we tell good writing from bad writing? Does that make sense? So all this discussion has actually been a kind of detour. They have never actually answered their question. And in fact, the way they answer their question is going to be very strange. Right? If presumably Socrates says, listen, we're going to talk about how we can separate good writing from bad writing, they don't actually really discuss it. What do? Socrates makes up a myth. Right? He makes up, I heard then at Naucratis in Egypt, there lived one of the old gods of that country. Right? So the bottom of 67 to 68. The one whose sacred bird is called the ibis. And the name of the divinity was Thuth. He's going to talk about the invention of writing. So in fact, when he's going to get to his critique of writing, it's not going to be based on his discussion with Phaedrus. It's going to be based on a myth that he made up that comes from nowhere. He says it might as well have come from an oak tree. He made it up. So it's not like a well-reasoned argument that he finally comes up with. It's not the back-and-forth dialogue. It's myth-making as a form of argumentation. Right, so what's wrong with writing according to this myth? Right, well, towards the bottom, around 275, it says, the fact is that this invention will produce forgetfulness in the souls of those who have learned it. They will not need to exercise their memories, being able to rely on what is written, calling things to mind no longer from within themselves by their own unaided powers, but under the stimulus of external marks that are alien to themselves. This is so complicated, right? Again, you get the Socratic distinction between what's yours, the things you own, versus the things that are alien, that come from without you. Does that make sense? Right? The presumably critique of writing is that it's something outside of you, right? It's externalized. While your spoken words, you're closer to them. You own them. You're the father of them. And yet, this inside-outside thing is so complicated because Socrates is going to constantly hear voices. Even at his moment of recantation of his speech, of his first speech, he says he hears voices. He says, I always hear that same voice. Is that voice alien or is that voice him? You hear voices in your head. Is it you or is it not you? What does it mean to be you? Maybe to be you is you are your collection of voices. Socrates sort of problematizes identity at this point. It seems like he's giving a very clear notion of identity, but performatively he keeps undermining it. Right? That you're never just self-same to yourself. You are already a composite, he says. You're already multiple things. You hear voices. You are a collection of voices to begin with. Means like, think back to Roland Barthes. Roland Barthes says, you look inside, it's not your passions. When you look inside, it's a dictionary. It's quotations. You see language. What does Socrates, when he looks inside, what does he get? Voices. More voices. Maybe they're divine voices, but they're voices nonetheless. And so, you know, you forget. Writing facilitates forgetting. It's not a recipe for memory, but for reminding. And as for wisdom, you're equipping your pupils with only a semblance of it, not with truth. Thanks to you and your invention, your pupils will be widely read without the benefit of a teacher's instruction. In consequence, they'll entertain the delusion that they have wide knowledge, while they are, in fact, for the most part, incapable of real judgment. Right? So he makes up a myth to finally critique writing. Right? Writing is further from the truth. Right? It's a semblance of the truth. It's not the truth itself. Right? And Socrates, if he just says, well, you made it up. And Socrates says, sure, I made it up, but does that really matter? And he says, well, nah. So then jump to the bottom, 69. Writing, you know, Phaedrus, has this strange quality about it, which makes it really like painting. The painter's products stand before us quite as though they were alive, but if you question them, they maintain a solemn silence. Did you ever see a movie, The Ring? Anyone see this film? The American one, not the Japanese, Korean, Japanese one. Japanese? Yeah. Ringu. Japanese, yeah, it was really boring. The American one's really beautiful. Do you see this movie? How many people did not see this movie? Some of you. Well, that movie is like a Socratic nightmare, right? Because it's about the image, right? I mean, this woman gives birth to an image. She doesn't actually give birth to a child. She gives birth to an image, right? And the image doesn't behave. It doesn't sleep. It doesn't need food. It just sits there solemnly, right? It's the great terror of what it means to be a painting or an image or writing. In a weird version, that movie, in a weird way, is this version of Plato's nightmare. Right? The text is silent. It looks like it's alive. But think about a movie. You look up there, look, it looks like it's alive. It's walking, it's talking. But if you ask it questions, it keeps saying the same thing back to you. It won't say anything to you. Right? Think about a photograph of yourself. You look at it, well, that's me. It looks like me. But you ask it questions and it won't respond. It just keeps staring at you. It's very strange, right? Now that might be a beautiful thing, or it might terrify you, right? In The Ring, it becomes a source of terror, right? And here for Socrates, he's a little ambivalent about it, right? You keep asking it questions, it won't say anything back. So too with written words. You might think they spoke as though they made sense, but if you ask them anything about what they are saying, if you wish an explanation, they go on telling you the same thing over and over forever. Once a thing is put in writing, it rolls about all over the place, falling into the hands of those who have no concern with it just as easily as under the notice of those who comprehend. It has no notion of whom to address or whom to avoid. Right? Notice that this is the same question of the lover, the non-lover. Who do you go to? Right? The non-lover really has no concern for the little boy. Right? It doesn't really, you roll around any which way, but when you have love, then you roll about the right way. You go to the right people. Does that make sense? The text here now, and their discussion of writing, is mimicking their discussion at the very beginning of the dialogue about the non-lover. To whom should you succumb? To whom should you be seduced? By whom should you be seduced? And when it is ill-treated or abused as illegitimate, it always needs its father to help it, being quite unable to protect or help itself. Now, as rhetoricians, this is really the beginning of the key to why I teach this text. As rhetoricians, you just read a critique of writing. I should always make your ears hot, right? Because you're reading something that's written, and it just told you about writing. So immediately it begs the very question of its own textuality, which is why I teach this text, right? This text cannot be read, I would argue, right, without its without the texture of its own textuality, without its own event of having been written, and occupying the strange space between the written and the spoken. Right? This text is not just a series of constative claims by Socrates and Phaedrus. It is always a performance. And here is the first, at least one moment at which the performance of the text is rather explicitly called in to question. Right? It's brought under our purview. Phaedrus says, well, you're quite right. And Socrates says, well then, are we able to imagine another sort of discourse, a legitimate brother of our bastard? How does it originate? How far is it better and more powerful in nature? Socrates says, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And Socrates says, a discourse which is inscribed with genuine knowledge in the soul of a learner. A discourse that can defend itself and knows to whom it should speak and before whom to remain silent. Peter says, do you mean the living, animate discourse of a man who really knows? Would it be fair to call the written discourse only a kind of ghost of it? What are they talking about? What is this real discourse? Spoken word. This dialogue, right? This sort of back and forth. Look on 71. Socrates is speaking about his second passage there. He says, so it is, dear Phaedrus, but in this regard, far more noble and splendid is the serious pursuit of the dialectician, who finds a congenial soul and then proceeds with true knowledge to plant and sow in it words which are able to help themselves and help him who planted them. Words which will not be unproductive, for they can transmit their seed to other natures and cause the growth of fresh words in them, providing an external existence for their seeds. That's an elaborately extended metaphor. Words which bring the possessor to the highest degree of happiness possible for a human being to attain. Right? This is begins to be kind of complicated because he's talking about words. Remember our whole dichotomy, words on one side, meaning on the other. It's not just the meaning here, but here he's talking about the performativity of words. You have to say the right words which can actually make actions, actually make something happen, actually transmit something. Right? But he does have this one condition, right, which is the noble and splendid is the serious pursuit of dialectician who finds a congenial soul. Does that describe this dialogue? Are Phaedrus and Socrates congenial souls? What do you think? Do they seem like two equals? Shooting the shit, trying to get at the truth? What's their relationship? You guys got it right on this. Not me. What do you think? What would you say is their relationship? Okay, teacher and pupil. Teacher and pupil. What about this teacher-pupil relationship? Is it just, is Phaedrus in fact learning from Socrates? Right. In fact, when Phaedrus says something, Socrates says, well, I thought you were going to say something else, which would have been right. Right. Phaedrus never seems to really stand up and turn the argument itself. Right. Trying to train him as opposed to perhaps teach him. I know the school my little boy goes to, they distinguish between training and learning, right? That most schools are premised on training. Sit in your chair, right? Recite these, you know, presidents, as opposed to learning, which is moving around, yeah. Fair enough. Some people might argue it's the same thing, but yeah, absolutely, right? There's a kind of puppeteering, right? And Socrates certainly isn't challenged. And is it a serious pursuit? Does he seem like a dialectician, Socrates? Right? Socrates says the dialectician really parses everything into its proper categories. Does Socrates do that? Does Socrates constantly kind of confuse categories, right? Is he ever serious? Right? Is he describing what they do here? No, but he is talking now about words, right? And words that, in fact, do things, right? Words that, said the right way at the right time, can cause growth. Right? So the status of the very words we're reading here, again, become questioned. What What is the status of the words we're reading? Could they be performing in a certain way upon us? All right. We're almost done here. So look at 72. So they go on and on. You know, a man must first know the truth about every single subject on which he speaks or write. He must be able to define each in terms of a universal class that stands by itself. When he successfully defined his subjects according to their specific, he goes on and on and on. This will become Aristotle's rhetoric later, but is this Socratic rhetoric? Is this how this dialogue proceeds? Does he create universal categories and then, you know, create his syllogisms to find out the truth? Or is it constantly this kind of back and forth, these slips and slides, these mishearings, these reverse ventriloquisms, this constant sort of play back and forth, rather than the establishing of a hierarchy of principles and sub-principles? Right, so he gives this whole notion of what the right thing to do is, but it's nothing that's happened remotely in this text. And Socrates says, well, now, what about the question of whether it is honorable or disgraceful to write and deliver speeches? Under what circumstances may this properly involve reproach? And what does it turn out? Look at 73. Socrates' big passage here. He says, on the other hand, there is the man who thinks that the written word on any subject necessarily contains much that is playful, and that no work, whether in verse or prose, has ever been written or recited that is worthy of serious attention. You just read a passage that said, you read a passage that's written that says, nothing that's ever been written, it is not possible to write something that's worth being taken seriously. Not one thing is being worth taking seriously if it's written down. You just read that. What happens to that claim when you read that? What's the obvious thing? It can't be taken seriously. Right? It's so complicated, right? It's almost like the person who says, you know, I lie. Well, am I telling the truth when I say I lie? Right? There's no way the sentence can happen. What do you mean?
Because if you don't take it seriously, then you are taking it seriously because that's what it says. You can't really
do either one. That's right. It puts you in this sort of very strange position, right? It puts you, I would argue, in an ironic position where you're forced to believe it and not believe it at the same time. Good. Absolutely. Absolutely. That was well put. Yeah, Vincent.
The comment that was made on, how you can't take it seriously.
Right.
It might also make sense of in terms of the relationship between the lover and the non-lover. Uh-huh. The way that the lover is kind of described as producing his own image in the non-lover.
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice. That's complicated. That's complicated. That's very nice. Everybody here, Vincent? You want to do it again? You want me to do it?
You can do it.
Right. So Vincent was talking about when Socrates was talking about the lover. What the lover does when he sees his beauty, his man, he projects himself onto that person. Is that right? Right. There's a projection of the lover onto his beloved. Right, and Socrates, right, vis-a-vis Phaedrus and vis-a-vis us, projects himself as lover onto us. Right, so what we're asked to do, in a sense, is become Socrates. Right? To live through Socrates. Right, not to hear what he says, but to live as he lives. Right, like imitatio Christo. Right, certain schools of Christianity where you don't listen. I've talked about Kierkegaard a little bit. Where you don't listen solely to what Jesus says. But you lead the life that Jesus led. Right? It's the beautiful line in the Gospels, right? He says, I'm the way. I am the life. Right? Which is very different than I am, my word is law. Right? Remember, Jesus comes down and smashes all the laws. He says, to hell with the laws. You have an individual relationship with God. You don't have to go through the temple. Right? I am the way. I am the life. And that's sort of what Socrates suggests here. I am the way. I am the life. This is the life to lead. The life of irony. Right? Which is not a law. Yeah.
Yeah. Related to writing,
yeah.
Assigned and also to semen, right?
Yeah. Is this all right? I love it. Yeah. So the planting of seeds, ink, and semen all blur right there.
And literally, that's we're getting an innuendo of the seduction, the sexual aspect, but it's also related to the planting of an idea
right. There is. I don't even know if we'll call those metaphors or metonyms. I guess they're metaphors. Right, this constant movement of metaphor. I mean, you could talk about the way this text moves, rather than moving through this reasoned universal arguments. Actually, moves through a constant kind of rhetorical slippage, right? Through metaphor, which brings together disparate things. Right, so you have the planting of seeds, you have the planting of semen, you have the planting of seeds of learning. Right, you have at least those three modes. Right? They're linked together somehow through language, through words. So this text, in a way, is assembled according to the fabric of text, according to the fabric of words. The very stitching of this text, the texture of this text, is woven together by this play on words. Does that make sense? Right? It's not just all of its noble ideas, but this kind of slippage of meanings of a similar word. A little like McLuhan. Right, who puns constantly, right? But the result and the effects are quite different, right? And the goals are quite different. If you could map how Socrates puns versus how McLuhan puns, you'd have a very good paper, right? And what's at stake in their respective punning tactics. Right, so nothing that's ever written down should be taken seriously. Nothing that's ever written down should be taken seriously. The minute you read that, this text, in case you miss the irony, for the previous 72 pages, took its fingers and poked you in the eyes. Right? Took its little fist, boom, punched you in the nose. Boom, punched you in the nose again. See? Can't take it seriously. The minute you see this, you have to go back and read the text again. Because nothing you can say, nothing, you can't take this text seriously. That's what he keeps telling you. Right? It's full of the performance, right? The very performance of the very thing that you're doing, reading, has been called into the here and now. At this exact moment, this text is no longer simply a series of constant claims. It is happening now in the very act of reading it. Does that make sense? Right? It's folded into the present. It's folded into the performative. And of course, it has been all along. But in case you missed it, at this point, it hits you over the freaking head. Right? Nothing that's written down should be taken seriously. And this applies to recitations of rhapsodies also, delivered for the sake of mere persuasion, which give no opportunity for questioning or exposition. The truth is that the best of these works merely serves to remind us of what we know already. However, complete lucidity and serious importance, he will think, belong only to those lessons in justice and beauty and goodness which are delivered for the sake of true instruction and are in fact inscribed in the soul. Is this Socrates? Right? Complete lucidity and serious importance? Lucidity, he hears voices. He uses words one way and then another. Right? He mishears Phaedrus. Is he completely lucid? Right? Are his lessons in justice and beauty and goodness delivered for the sake of true instruction? He doesn't even actually effectively instruct Phaedrus. He fails in his instruction of Phaedrus. How does he fail? He fails because Phaedrus is not ironic at the end. Phaedrus thinks he knows now. Right? So the next time he sees Phaedrus, he's going to have to go through this again, and then Phaedrus will go to the other side, and back and forth, and back and forth. Phaedrus has actually, in fact, not learned to be ironic. He's used Phaedrus as a foil for us. We've become the students. Such discourses as these should be counted as his own legitimate children, a name to be applied first to those who take their source within himself, and secondarily to any of their offspring or brothers that may have worthily been implanted within the souls of others. To other kinds of discourse, you will pay no attention. Does that mean stop reading? To other kinds of discourse, pay no attention. Done. Okay. I guess we shut the text at that point. Pay no mind. You're reading the freaking thing. Right? So there will always have been this third voice in this dialogue from the get-go. There will have been Phaedrus, there will have been Socrates, and the third voice is Plato. Another word for Plato is the text, Phaedrus. There will always have been the text, the act of inscribing this thing that's written. Right? So you get this, the very conditions of this text are ironic from the get-go. The relationship between Plato and Socrates is ironic from the get-go. Socrates says, never take anything written seriously. Plato writes it down. It's the only way we know what Socrates says. Plato writes it down. Good. Very good. Say more. So why does that matter? Very good. Very good. Very nice, right? So he says, you know, at the top of that passage, he says, on the other hand, there is a man. There is a man. He doesn't say, I think these things. He says, there is a man who thinks these things. And it's delivered as if this is the critique of writing. But again, Socrates hasn't taken responsibility for it. He's spoken it through another character. Right? Sort of amplifies the ambivalence, amplifies the play that's happening in this text. Right? At this moment where Socrates seems to be saying you have to be absolutely self-present to yourself, he's not self-present to himself. He's speaking again through a kind of character, a kind of ventriloquism. But instead of Phaedrus, he's made another character. A kind of another dummy has entered the scene. This man who says these things. It's not Socrates. It's not this text. It's some other voice. Right? Very good. Such a man as this, Phaedrus, is probably the sort of man that you and I might do well to pray we might become. I like all those qualifications. It's probably the sort of man we might do well to pray we might become. Phaedrus, a little more on Phaedrus. With all my heart, I wish and pray it may be so. Then enough of this amusement of ours with speeches. We have given it its due. Do you go and tell Lysias, and the two of us went down to the stream in the sanctuary of the nymphs, and there we heard voices instructing us to tell Lysias and all those other prose writers and Homer and all those people who write to be recited or sung. And in the third place, Solon and all the other writers who compose political tracts under the name of laws, and then quote again. This is so hilarious. So he's talking about we need to critique all the prose writers, but he's saying we were instructed by these other people, by these other voices, to tell the prose writers. So in a way, he read prose to go tell the prose writers, and then he creates prose to go tell the prose writers. Right? There's another quote. If a man composes his work with the full knowledge of the truth, and can come to the aid of what he has written. He's quoting. He's not speaking himself again. He's creating a character. He's writing. The exact moment he's telling prose writers not to be prose writers, he's writing in prose. He's quoting. He's not even attempting to speak self-present. So in fact, you get two quotes here. There's Socrates in quotes, and then there's the quotes of Plato around the quotes. Right? So you get this kind of double quotation here. Right? Just to amplify the play. Again, just in case you missed it. It comes out and punches you in the nose. Right? Hopefully stings your eyes a little bit. And you go, ooh, I got this thing all wrong. I got to reread it. All right. Then Phaedrus says, then what names would you assign him? To call him wise, it seems to me, Phaedrus, is too overwhelming a term to be applied properly to any but a god. To call him a lover of wisdom or something similar would be more fitting and more seemly. Again, what do we call a lover of wisdom?
Philosopher.
Lover of wisdom. And again, here you have the lover again shown back up. Right? Lover of wisdom here. The lover, this speech again will have been woven together through this texture of metaphors. Lovers of wisdom, lovers of language. Right? Lovers of lovers. Socrates says, yes, on the other hand, a man who has nothing more worthwhile to show us than the works he has written, or rather put together, spending hours twisting phrases this way or that, pasting in this and pruning that, such a man you would no doubt be right to call a poet or a speechwriter or a drafter of laws. Who does that sound like? Who is this person who spends hours twisting phrases this way or that? Right? Pasting in this and pruning that. It's both Socrates and Plato. It's this text. Right? This text seems all cut up, doesn't it? Again, the philologists had a hard time with this text because it doesn't seem just to flow, doesn't just stay on topic. It seems to move all over the place. Right? And so here he's saying, you know, people who do that, we'll call those speech writers. So this is a speech. We just read a speech. The whole thing has to have been a speech. Right? Because it's just pruned here, twisted there. Right? This is poetry or speech writing. That means did we ever hear Socrates in the first place? Could we have ever heard Socrates? How do Socrates and Plato speak to each other? How can Socrates possibly speak if he says that speaking should always be verbal? That's it. Then they talk about their friends and they should go pray, and then Socrates says, enough, enough, let's get out of here. And they go back home. That's the Phaedrus, right? Done. Easy, right? This text is easy. It's easy. Okay. It is, because you are the people equipped to write about it. Right? Because you're the rhetoricians who read for the performative. This text can't really happen without the performative. If you read this text solely on its constitutive claims, you end up at some point in a kind of absurdity, or you miss the text altogether. This text calls into question its own textuality, its own having been written-ness, over and over again. And in fact, that becomes its instruction. It becomes a pedagogic text, a performative pedagogy that teaches us as readers to recognize the performative, and in particular, the ironic. And that's why I end with this text. Right? Because without the tools that we've assembled so far in the semester, you wouldn't know how to read this text. And in fact, when you go and read this in a classics seminar, you'll get a very different version of it. When you read it for 103A in rhetoric, you're going to get a very different version of it. And that version won't be wrong, but it'll be very different. Right? And you'll remember this reading of it. It's going to be very hard for you to write your paper. And you'll probably get a C. Right? But, you know, it's, again, you know, some people are having some issues with this text, with so-called getting into it, whatever the hell that means. But part of what I've been hopefully teaching you is that when you read for the performative, when you read rhetorically, everything is interesting. There's nothing that you can't read, that you can't spin. Nothing. Right? Because things aren't examples of universal laws. Everything's particular, and it assembles itself in these very strange ways. So here's a text, a great freaking text, an unbelievably complicated text. You should certainly be able to sink your teeth into here and spin it one way or another. You should have no problem. So let's talk about it as a performative pedagogy, briefly. Right? What does that mean? It's a great phrase, isn't it? I made it up. I love it. One, because I really like alliteration. That's why I like Nabokov. Maybe I like alliteration because I like Nabokov. Which came first? Right. So what do I mean, a performative pedagogy? It's a beautiful phrase. I might even argue that this class functions as a performative pedagogy, that if you listen only to what I say, you know, you're only going to get half of it. Now, part of, you know, if I talk about other things in this class, seeming digressions, things like baseball, things like my kid, they're not digressions at all. But maybe they serve a function. Maybe they're a contrivance, right? That I've actually been concocted to perform a pedagogic function. What function could that be? Exactly. Raymond Queneau.
Those are also very, very performative,
yes,
in that they show the text being all cut up and manipulated,
yes,
in ways that is very different in order to show us what they want us to understand.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Every text is performative, necessarily. those texts really call it out. This text is a great one because it wants to slip under the radar in a way, right? It wants to seem like it's a series of constant claims, and you could build a Platonic philosophy, Socratic philosophy from this, right? And I think a text like this, if one weren't trained properly, one would miss the performative component. Although I think it punches you in the face, right? But there are people who really believe that that's the Platonic position, to critique that writing is always false, which it is, and it isn't. Augustus. Absolutely.
Book you were given.
Yeah.
And all of those, it's just like the words, they just, it's like usually when somebody writes something, they're in contradiction with what they're saying based off the mold they're using, whatever, but none of these are. And
right.
That's the thing. I mean, some of these, they pop up out of the book and it's like 3D, they're tangible, you can touch
them. Right. Right, absolutely, right? So this notion of performative pedagogy is that it teaches you in its going, in its mode of performing, rather than just giving you the set of rules. Right? So this text, I would argue, can be read as a performative pedagogy. I mean, it really is set up explicitly as a student-teacher relationship. I would just argue that the student is not Phaedrus, that the student is the reader, because the reader is witness to the text itself. Here's one way to think about this. I talked about this the other day, Augustus, right? You ever Looney Tunes versus Disney? It's one of my returning tropes I come back to. You know Looney Tunes, like Bugs? You know, Chuck Jones and the whole Looney Tunes phenomenon, right? They're philosophers. They're genius. Bugs Bunny is one of the great American actors. One of probably the greatest tactician to ever walk the earth. Right? I mean, what can't Bugs get out of? Right? You have a lot to learn from Bugs. Bugs is like the American Sun Tzu. Right, so you have Looney Tunes on one hand, you have Disney on the other, contemporary Disney. You know, when you watch a Disney film, and I have to admit I have failed in every attempt to watch a Disney film because they are egregious, right? But there's, I know there's one with like a little fish, right? And I tried watching my little boy, and he was terrified by the sharks in the first scene, so we could never watch it. He freaked out. Something about Nemo, losing Nemo, finding Nemo, is that right?
Right?
And there's a character, Nemo, right, that you identify with. And then you go through a whole story of identification with Nemo, and you go, oh, I hope Nemo goes okay. Right? Go Nemo. Right? When you watch Looney Tunes, you don't root for any of the characters, per se. You get the whole thing. You get the whole screen. You get the text itself as an event. Right, you got Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner. It's their relationship. It's the whole phenomena of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner that is the text. Right, it's the conditions of fundamental lack. Right, that is a Lacanian text par excellence, isn't it? Poor Wile E. Coyote is never going to get what he wants. He wants that Roadrunner so bad, but he ain't ever going to get it. He ain't ever going to get him. Right. And so when you watch Looney Tunes, it's actually a sophisticated text. It operates at the level of its textuality. All the elements are in place simultaneously, and that's what they give you, right? When you watch Disney, you identify with a character, right? I'm just like that Nemo, right? And of course, you're basically, you know, have no gumption or anything remotely interesting about you, but you're sweet. Right? That's the contemporary trope for kids. They did it to Sesame Street, too. Everybody's sweet on Sesame Street now. There's no Grover anymore. They got rid of Oscar, too. He's faded into the background. He's growing up with Sesame Street, there was Oscar. It's like a homeless guy, you know, who's mean. And then there's Grover, who's demented. I mean, he's really schizo. And Cookie Monster? Cookie Monster is a fetishist par excellence. I mean, he's nuts. He loves those cookies so much. But now it's that, what's that little shithead, Elmo, right? It's unbelievable, right? It's been castrated of its zaniness. My point being this, that when you read this text, you can identify with Phaedrus. But then, in a way, you can't. You, if you, who can you identify with here? Right? It's not like a play where it's like, oh, I'm Phaedrus and I'm learning from Socrates. Well, Phaedrus is a moron. That's apparent. You have no, you don't identify with him. So what you get is the text as a whole. So rather than identification, you get the text. You get textuality. You get these voices speaking in this various way, this whole assemblage, like Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner. Right? You get a whole concoction, a whole symphony of voices that play off each other. Right? Does that make some sense? Right? So when you read this text, again, it's not that you are the learner and Socrates is the teacher. What you are privy to is the entire exchange between Socrates and Phaedrus and Plato. You get all these things speaking, and they play on you. Right? And so we become, I tried to draw that on the board the other day, that elaborate map. Should I draw it again? Because it was so effective. Right? But on the one hand, you have Phaedrus' narrative arc, which is basically finding Nemo. Right? Phaedrus, Nemo. Right? He's lost. Now he's found. Right? I mean, it's the same stupid fucking narrative over and over again. Right? That Hollywood loves. Nemo, right? So he's found. Right? He moves to philosophy. Does that make sense? That if you track Phaedrus' movement in this text, he seems to go through a transition. Is that fair to say? He begins at rhetoric, and he ends at philosophy. He begins as a lover of Lysias, who's really a non-lover, and ends up with Socrates, who's really a lover, in some sense. Although it's the reverse, too. But we'll leave that alone for a moment. Is that true? Yeah. It is no one. That's hilarious. That is no one. Don't watch those Disney films. So this makes sense? There's some narrative arc for Phaedrus, right? Is that fair? Right. Is there a narrative arc for us? Do we follow this same narrative arc? Do we move from rhetoric to philosophy? Or do we, in fact, discover something else entirely, which is irony, which has no narrative arc? Right? Irony is always the same. Here's a question I actually didn't put on the prompts that I had a few semesters ago, which I think is a good one. Socrates, in a way, introduces this kind of play, right? This kind of ambivalence, this irony, right? He's neither this nor that. Right? But in the same time, he's actually quite consistent. His self, in a way, he's always the same. His answer will always be the same. It will always be irony. How do you deal here? Ironically. What's called for here? Irony. In a way, he's kind of always the same. So I wanted to compare the Socratic movement, the Socratic ambivalence to poetical dictionary and the notion of a Protean standard. Right? The notion of a standard that changes constantly in circumstance. Because Socrates, in many ways, is distinctly not Protean. He's constantly moving, but he's not necessarily constantly changing. Right? In this weird way, Socrates sort of stays the same as this kind of, I don't even know how to draw irony, right? It's this kind of back and forthness, right? This constant kind of play. You can see information design is tricky. Anybody here ever do information design? It's tricky. Right? How do you represent these things? Right? Does this make some sense as Socrates here? Right? Socrates stays as this kind of hum, but he goes between one point and its opposite, one point and its opposite, one point and its opposite, one point and its opposite. He's constantly going back and forth. Right? This constant kind of movement. Is that fair to say? Right. Okay. Yes, I see where you're going, yes.
To you that nothing has really changed at all in this whole dialogue.
Very good.
He's just going to go back to Lysias and agree with everything he said.
Right, very good. Everybody hear what Kate says? In a way, Peter doesn't go through any transformation at all. He stays exactly the same. He's always univocal. He has this one position, he goes to this other position. Someone will argue the opposite or go back the other way. He's a yes man. He's not a yes no man. That's actually kind of nice. If we say Phaedrus is a yes man, Socrates is the yes and no man. Right? So we're saying yes and no. So in a way, this narrative this transformative narrative is a false narrative. Right? Because he will never actually have been transformed. I like that. Complicating it all the more. Yeah.
It seems that he brings Phaedrus over to his side the entire time, and then as he kicks him back to Lysias, it's kind of like a testimony there to like the power of the rhetoric. He's like, "Ha! I convinced you. I seduced you.
Yeah. He kind of washes him up, sends him back to Lysias. That's hilarious. There's a very perverse paper to be written there. Right. So, and again, this becomes kind of a false narrative. Right? Socrates doesn't change at all. And then there's our transformation. Right? And our transformation happens precisely because this is the text. Right? So we don't have to follow Nemo or this, right? We follow the relationship between these things. Does that make sense? Right? We get is the text as a whole. Right? We get this thing. Right? Socrates is a character in here, Phaedrus is a character in here, but we read this. Right? So we don't have to identify with one or the other. Again, sort of like Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner. You could say, oh, that poor Wile E. Coyote, or go Roadrunner, but that would be silly. Right? Because the whole point is the relationship between them. Right? And each one needs the other to kind of make it happen. And that becomes the text that is, the Roadrunner. Does that make sense? Do you guys know what I'm talking about with Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner?
Yeah.
Looney Tunes still exist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused about the distinction between Socratic irony and the changing standard in political dictionary, because it seems like irony is like a consistent.
Yes, exactly. That's my point.
But isn't that what Lauren Green is doing too then? A consistent standard?
How is it consistent? Yeah, that's good. I like that. But it's complicated because the thing about his response is going to be different every time. Right? So Socrates, no matter what, is always going to be ironic. He's going to read, if you picture Socrates' version, this is a good way to see it, picture the Socratic version of Poetical Dictionary. All his definitions are going to be ironic. He couldn't possibly define serious. He couldn't possibly, right? He couldn't be serious to define serious. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to everybody?
Their relationship, like the difference is found in their relationship to the word.
Yes, absolutely, very good, right? If you wanted to speak to that textually, right, talk about what is a word to Lauren Green, what is a word to Socrates, right? And what does it mean to speak a word, write a word, the word to utter a word? In a way, all semester we're talking about what is the value of an utterance. What happens when you write or speak, when you enter language? Every text we've talked about has some take on how you operate in language. Right? And they're all slightly different. They all have slightly different things at stake. So you ready to write this paper? You all done? Easy, right? It's like the easiest paper in the world to write. I'm serious. There's so much here. Right? So my advice to you is to find a good hook. Find a good textual moment. And speak to that. Unpack it. Speak to, I tried to give you that manfully, madly. Tried to argue out the whole text and be spoken through that one passage. Right? You need a good hook. The key to a good paper is a hook.
And I guess just as metaphors, Matt Nietzsche talks about how metaphors are always already there. In a sense, irony, by extension, would always already be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And irony, of course, is one of the so-called master tropes. Talk about the master tropes in here. We did a little bit. Irony, metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche, and irony. According to Kenneth Burke, modern rhetorician, there are four master tropes. All the tropes can be spoken through these four. Everything else is a version of them, which is silly, of course. You know what the master trope is? It's got to be catachresis, right? Doesn't it? Catachresis just means a deformation of the words. Doesn't it have to be all tropes? Aren't all tropes catachresis? I don't know. Aren't you writing on rhetoric? Isn't that your argument about catachresis? No. Didn't we talk about this? Yeah. I argue it's all metonymy, but there you go. But irony is one of the great tropes, right? And again, what's nice about irony is that it irony positions itself at that point at which language is in fact uttered, right? Because it's always in the saying of something you efface it, right? It's that part of in the saying, right? It's always temporal. It's always happens. It's an experience. It's something. It can't be fixed. Right? It can't just be constative. It's always a relationship between the performative and the constative. That's where irony happens. You don't have to. I just think that's a nifty way in, right? I think an easy way in. That's why I have a lot of them suggest a kind of, not comparison, but a bringing forth of a similar strategies to show this one's different, right? I think that can often be an effective way to reveal. I mean, you really want to talk about how this text is different. You don't want to say how, oh, they're all the same. They all talk about play. But what's interesting is how Socratic play is different than McLuhan's play, is different than Nietzsche's play, is different than Barthes' play. They all have a different function of play, different tactics. But bringing in another text is a good way to sort of reveal the differences in this text. Do the prompts then all make sense to you? I'm not going to talk about the paper again. So this is it. You got questions about this paper? Bring them on.
Yes, sir. I don't know how to formulate this question, but I was thinking about like the Lauren Green's discussion of the body of a word as a sort of concept, and then Dr. Hubin's discussion of like the body as opposed to the immaterial. And I was just sort of wondering like if they're making different arguments or if
good. It's an excellent question. Let's talk about it a little bit. I mean, I don't think Poetical Dictionary actually ever is ironic, right? Because what happens in Poetical Dictionary is that the sense of or the meaning of a word and its body are oddly commensurate, right? They oddly always sort of amplify each other. They speak back and forth and augment each other, right? They sing infinitely to the heavens, right? In some sense, or through this world, where for Socrates, the meaning and the word are always at odds. Right? There's always a gap there for Socrates. Right? There will always be a necessary failure of language. There's no other way. Language always fails for Socrates, and yet you still speak. And it's that second move that makes Socratic irony. This body fails. This mortality fails. Right? It will never speak the truth. Language can never be spoken, and yet we speak. So how do you speak if language always fails? You speak ironically. You say it, but you don't really mean it. I'm sorry. We have to start again. You know, I don't like dogs. I think they want to kill me. I think they smell, and I think they're needy. They're the worst species, right? They offer the worst, right? They just need. But they have one thing I kind of love, which is when they hear something they don't quite understand, they go. Yeah. So that's what I'm doing now. Huh? Start again. Ah, well, that's what he says. But if you actually go back through the text and try to map how he, because it's actually an important aspect of Socratic argument and what he's often critiqued for, which he would celebrate if you ever read the Gorgias, one of the other great rhetorical texts of Socrates. We'll talk about the natural versus the conventional. We're not giving too much talk. the natural versus the conventional definition, right? Right. So he'll go back and forth. So when he says the lover, which lover does he mean? He constantly goes back and forth between them, right? Well, Phaedrus is a lover of Lysias's, but in the conventional sense or in the natural sense? Well, they are lovers. Socrates and Phaedrus are, in fact, not lovers, but maybe they're lovers in the natural sense. So he'll use the word back and forth in different ways, right? So when he says he's a lover of words, in what way does he mean it, right? He'll constantly be moving through the natural and the conventional. So his definition of words is actually never quite consistent. Precisely because the definition of words will always be ironic, will always be both natural and conventional. Does that make any sense to you? He'll claim you need to be self-consistent, but he never will be. Right? And this is the grounds on which people always critique Socrates, right? I mean, to explain, does this natural and conventional make some sense? You can think about the word successful, right? You're trying to explain to your parents, you know, look at so-and-so, he's successful. And what they mean by successful is he went and he got a job and he got married and now he goes home every night, takes Ambien and wishes he were dead, right? And that's successful, right? But your notion of success, and they're looking at you, they're yelling at you, and, you know, you're working at a coffee shop 2 days a week and, you know, smoking spleeps every day and, you know, drinking nice tequila and eating sushi, and they're like, you're not successful, but you're like, I am successful. Right? You're invoking a different notion of success. There's the conventional notion of success, and there's a different notion of success. Right? So that's the natural conventional distinction. Yeah.
Is that the distinction you get in here between an idea that's arrived at through finding its essence as opposed to the conventional being the appearance of something?
Yeah, that might be nice, yes. Yes.
Conventional meaning of a word.
Yes.
Whereas the philosopher actually tries to find what its nature
Very
is.
Very nice. Yes. Very good. Very good. Right? So presumably, what is true success? What's the essence of success? Oh, it just means living the good life. Living in the light of truth, you know, whatever the heck you're doing when you're working at your coffee shop and, you know, smoking your spleefs. Right? Where, you know, it's all outward appearances. The guy who's married and drives his Beamer and, you know, works 60 hours a week at some horrendous, I don't know where that got defined as success. You can see that what ends up being combined conventionally as success is where a lot of power lies. Right? When that gets considered success, and now you have to explain to your parents why you're not going to do that. Why should you even have to waste your time? If you go to do that, they should slap you on the hand. Don't go do that. Don't get married and breed. It's certain death. I've done it. I'm serious. It's unbelievable, right? Now, what Socrates does is constantly move between these definitions. He constantly moves between essence and appearance. He constantly uses one, uses the other. Uses one, uses the other, right? Because you'll never just get at the essence. Why? Because the essence of something is invisible, formless, ineffable. It exists elsewhere. Anything per se is only a memory, right? Appearance points to essence. It's just a memory of the essence.
Can I ask a question back to our other topic?
Sure.
Okay. So you said that like each author has something different in the way they relate to words. So what's at stake in an ironic relationship as opposed to a sincere relationship?
Who has a sincere relationship?
Well,
I don't know if it's necessarily sincere. Sense and it's not oppositional for him, right? I mean, one of the main differences for Socrates, is the first text that really operates in a logic of opposition, right? I spent a lot of time this semester critiquing opposition, and now you get Socrates who operates within the logic of opposition. You have the mortal or the divine, the word or the meaning, and they constantly speak to each other, but irony is the thing that navigates opposition, the yes and the no, right? For Lauren Green, these things aren't opposed to begin with. That's the whole point. A sense and meaning are you don't separate them. They're a chiasmus. There you go. That's the green trope. The green trope is chiasmus. Right? Remember what chiasmus is? Chiasmus is intertwining. right? So sense and meaning are marbled. Can you picture marble? Right, that's sort of black and white, all intimately meshed together. That's how Lauren Green imagines sense and meaning. Right, you can't separate them. They're so bound up with each other. You might be able to see the distinctions, but the word is, in fact, both things at once as a piece of marble. While for Socrates, there will always be this gap, right, between the appearance of something and the essence of something, between the natural and the conventional. Irony exists in the space in between.
For
Socrates, what's at stake is living this life while still living in the life of God, right? While still speaking to divinity. I mean, the stakes for Socrates are quite high. That if you don't speak ironically, you end up offending the gods, right? That either you go too mortal, and one thing he doesn't speak to are the people who go too divine, but it's implied in there. Right, that you still have this mortal coil. You don't shed it. He's not an ascetic. He says, I need the city. He leaves the city for a day. He says, this is weird for me. I want to go back. He's not an ascetic. He wants to live amongst men. He likes boys. He likes wine. He likes nature. Right? So it's neither one nor the other. But what's at stake is precisely how do you live your life? Right? And for Lauren Green, you might be able to argue the same thing, that what's at stake is how you live your life. Because that's true of every text. But more directly, you might say, what's at stake is knowledge. Right? How do we know things? What do we count as knowledge? What counts in this world as something to be known? Yeah, I think it's everything you just said. Right? That it's, first of all, that argument, he argues at one point that argument needs to be premised on these universal claims. You need to create your categories. Yet in his myths, he sometimes does that, sometimes doesn't. Sometimes he just makes stuff up. Right? So it seems to be, it's an alternate mode of argument that speaks against the mode of argument he puts forth. Yeah, it's good. It's an excellent question, right? I think talking about the role of myth in these two texts is a great, great topic. Right? So for Nietzsche, myth-making is a kind of speaking of the truth precisely because it's liquid, precisely because it can endlessly morph. And this other truth he suggests is the truth of nature, which knows no truth, knows no forms. Right? So precisely what Nietzsche loves about myth is precisely its flexibility. You never know what's going to happen. Endless differentiation. That's what he says about the Greeks. They never know what's going to happen. Right? Athena herself might march down the street. You never know. The tree might end out to be a wood nymph. Did I make up the wood nymph thing? Is that like some weird leftover Dungeons and Dragons fetish I have? The wood nymph. I don't know what that is. right? But I can't stop saying wood nymph. It becomes some kind of wood nymph. And you never know. It could be anything any second. Right? Now, is that true for Socrates? Does Socrates have that same play? Now, so what role does it play? Right? In some ways, myths for him do speak a kind of truth, but that again, it will always be in this ironic mode, right? It will always repeat irony, right? In that you give the myth, you do mean it as the truth, but at the same time, you never know the truth, right? Nietzsche never makes that double move. Nietzsche doesn't believe you have to say, I don't know the truth. What he wants to do is take the truth and make it, it's moot. I don't have to worry about it. I just got to make shit up, make up lots of stuff. Right? So it's a move to proliferation. So where for Nietzsche, here's one way to think about it. For Nietzsche, he says, what is truth? It is a mobile army of metaphors, metonymies. What's the word he uses? He does synecdoche, but it's personifications. Right? Anthropomorphisms, right. Thank you, right? So it's a mobile army. It's all these different things. For Socrates, it's always irony. Socrates is one trope. Does that help at all? I think you're in the right area. It's a very good topic, yeah.
On that question and passage that might be worth looking at is when Phaedrus asks Socrates, what do you think? Do you think these myths are all true? And Socrates redirects the question to, all of my researches go into myself. My constant question is what sort of thing am I? So I would wonder that if that might be taken, if you use that passage potentially to argue that that's exactly how, like, Socrates tells you, everything that I say is going to be about me.
Okay.
So myth then will have to be about the question, who am I, following that imperative.
Okay. That's nice. Can you hear Vincent at all? That for Socrates, right, the question he'll constantly return to is you have to know yourself. That's what he's told. The oracle tells him at Delphi, right? He's got to know himself. And so he makes up these myths, but they're really finally all an interrogation into who he is. Right? Who am I? I have to know myself. So all of this going is to know himself. While for Nietzsche, nothing could interest Nietzsche less than knowing thyself. Right? Nietzsche just wants to play in the sand. He wants to play in the dirt. He wants to get dirty. He wants to run around. He wants to make shit. He wants to scramble the world.
And beyond that, you could tie it back into what you were saying about irony. Because, you know, the thing that we would probably identify most with Socrates is that ironic mode. So
yeah,
myth
yeah.
is all about irony.
Yes. Yeah, that's what we were saying before. Yes. Right? So myths have this, they also have this ironic relationship to knowledge, that they both proffer the truth at the same time that it's a truth that you can never know. So it's, they both mean it and don't mean it. While for Socrates, for Nietzsche, it's a great moment where he's like, the honest Athenian believe this. The honest Athenian. It's a hilarious moment, right? Where there's a goddess walking down the street and the honest Athenian believes it, right? So for Nietzsche, it's really odd, right? Where myth-making is at once truth-making, but at the same time, it's endlessly morphologic, endlessly shifting, endlessly in flux, right? I mean, all the texts we read up into, and I think the reason you guys aren't, I think there's a bit of resistance always to this text, is all the texts we've read up to here are really about this proliferating play. And when you get to Socrates, he really limits his play. He really operates in opposition, not in dissemination, not in proliferation. Right? The Protean standard goes away. He's really interested in one thing over and over again, which is irony. And again, it's one reason I like to teach it, because it is radically different than the other texts. But that shouldn't matter to you. You should be able to make sense of it, too. And it is still a kind of play. It's just a different kind of play. Right? I found irony. I mean, I couldn't shake the irony forever. I mean, to me, it was the only way to go. Right? I was about to write my dissertation on irony. I was like, this is it. Kierkegaard's dissertation is called The Concept of Irony with Constant Reference to Socrates, which is a hilarious title. And he actually got permission. If you ever want to read something really funny, read the beginning of his dissertation, because all dissertations in Denmark were supposed to be in Latin, and he got permission to write his in Danish, and it was a big deal. There were a lot of people there. It was a big scene, and he just mocks everybody in the academy in his dissertation, right? It's hilarious. He just goes through each one. He goes, the so-called, you know, the presumably learned, and he starts quoting all the people who are judging him. And he just mocks one after the other. But they can't fail him, because he did say you were learned. Right? Like, it was irony, but what can they say? He did say it. Right? And so if you read the critiques of his dissertation, they're all like, oh, I want to strangle him, but we have to pass him. Right? It's just, irony becomes a great figure to navigate power. Right? Shadi Barch, who used to teach here in classics in rhetoric, wrote a great book on irony and resistance to power under some Caesar or something. I don't know what the fuck she wrote about. As a mode of resistance to power, right? Because you can always say, you know, I mean, you know, the boss comes over and says, you know, are you feeling good about this project? You're really excited? And of course you're not excited. It's fucking work. You just want to go home. You say, sure am, boss. Right? It's this weird moment, right? Because what's he going to say? Right? So irony becomes a way of maintaining dignity while you're being bludgeoned by the unrelenting stupidity of the world. So I was very attracted to irony for that reason, even though I often fail at it. Because I have a will to honesty. Okay. For Thursday, hold on. Do you have a question there?
We have class 8.
No, we have class the 6th. Yeah, so last day of class is Tuesday. Yeah, you have section the last week? Or no, not after the 6th, right?
So it's like next week as
well. We have class next Tuesday, but I don't think there are sections after that. I think the last day of classes is the 6th.
I thought the last day of classes was the
12th.
Are you serious? We got a whole nother week?
Yeah.
Are you sure?